Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with...
Kimberly Gilbert, and I'm playing Billy Dawn.
And...
Cody Nickel, and playing Paul Verrill.
Of course, in the show Born Yesterday, Garson Kanin's classic play, now at Ford's Theater through October 21st. Thanks so much for coming in, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Now, I know a lot of people might be familiar with either the play or the movie. I'm a huge movie guy, so I, of course, think Judy Holliday. I mean, she won the Oscar for that, but I believe she played it on Broadway first, correct?
She sure did.
And now you're in her shoes. How much do you actually, were you familiar with it before you took this role? Or how much do you, like, divorce that from your mind when you're playing
it? Yeah, well, I first watched that movie. I must have watched it with my mother probably maybe 15 years ago, you know, watching Turner Classic Movies, and it was on. And then, of course, there was the lovely adaptation remake with Melanie Griffith. And I just recently saw it on the big screen because the AFI was showing it this summer.
In Silver Spring?
In Silver Spring. And so I went there and I watched it. And so I have a lot of moments in the play where it's definitely homage to Judy, because I think she worked on the play for almost, like, they ran for like 2 years, I think, on Broadway before they even brought it to the silver screen. So
I think it's 1946, I think, right?
Yeah. And then the movie was made in 1950. So yeah. I mean, it was in her bones, and so you can't you can't ignore genius when it's created for that many years and that many performances that have marinated. You can't help but steal from that, because it was beautiful and perfect. But I am myself, so I of course will make my own choices, but a lot of influence of Judy Holliday, a lot of influence also Marissa Tomei. I watched jump cut scenes from My Cousin Vinny, because I think she has that kind of Brooklyn gumption that I was looking for to work on, and then just, you know, my own goofy sprinkles that I put out throughout the play.
I like the goofy sprinkles.
Yeah. Me too. They're delicious.
And you, sir, you're
they
doing...
cover me. I'm covered in Kimberly's goofy sprinkles.
Yeah, you can't see it now because it's radio, but he's covered in goofy sprinkles.
Yeah.
Just like William Holden, right? I think. Was he covered?
William Holden was in it and totally covered in Judy Holliday's goofy sprinkles. But I actually didn't watch a movie. I tend to not do that stuff. I know that I've seen it probably in my youth, and I've definitely seen the Melanie Griffith, Don Johnson one, probably when it was actually out. But I tend to avoid that kind of thing when I'm building a part, just for me personally. So yeah, I didn't watch it. Rewatch it.
Yeah. And of course, the big juice behind all this, of course, is the text itself. Garson Kanin. I mean, a lot of people. I mean, people need to realize that. I mean, I believe he wrote this play, but then he and his wife was Ruth Gordon, right? Of Rosemary's Baby and Heron Maud. I mean, she's a legend. Mm-hmm. But they were this husband wife duo, and I believe they also wrote Adam's Rib in 49 for, and Judy Holliday was in that with Hepburn and Tracy, and then they did Born Yesterday. So it's funny how it all ties together. But what about Kanin here? I guess Ruth Gordon's not with him yet, but this is him just writing. But what about this? Why is he so witty in his writing here?
I was thinking about this yesterday. There's a phrase that you use in this script, Cody, called nice work. And it's this, and you know, I'm assuming it's hearkening to Nice Work If You Can Get It, that song. You know that song, but like, it was topical then. So he takes pop culture and puts it into his script and isn't afraid to just shorten it or make it so that the people who are watching the play then go, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. But how he writes, so how I feel that he writes is succinct. In terms of action and movement, but also he wasn't afraid to make it of the time, and so it really is this time capsule of how certain people spoke in the late 40s, post World War II, and I don't know it is quite beautiful, and it's quite specific too. He's not making it sloppy. He's making it kind of generalized. Like it is a score of music almost.
And how, I mean, you're talking about how it's referencing pop culture of its day, and there was a lot of winks to the audience at the time. How do you keep that, you know, What about that sort of still translates to today? Or how do you keep that, you know, fresh so it's not like you're just watching just a time capsule, but also that modern audiences?
I think that it actually is really easy to do because I think that kind of pop vernacular is still in us. Mm-hmm. The words might have changed a little bit, but that kind of rhythm, that kind of, I mean, it's all born out of kind of the American theatrical tradition of vaudeville, and those rhythms are still very much in play in our comic sense now. I think the phrasing might be slightly different to your ear, but it pops, like Kimberly said, it is very musical, and that kind of comic rhythm is innate in him, and it's fast-paced, and everybody's really, really smart. Even the people that are supposed to be, you know, quote-unquote dumb in the play, everybody's got a brain that moves a 1,000 miles a minute. So that kind of rapid fire wit of screwball comedies of the day, which we still get now, is all really present.
I think about, I'm so sorry, I forget her name, who created Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
That kind of quick, rapid fire dialogue that you have with everybody.
A little Lorelei action.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Makes me marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is why I think that show is doing so wonderfully, because it is of that era of this of the play that we're doing right now. But it's like same recipe, just different ingredients, really. Like it's like the same structure that works, and if it works, then don't fix it.
Yeah, you're right. A lot of those shows wouldn't exist without.
And I will say that a number of times, people have come up to me after the show and said, "Oh, how many things did you guys change to make it relevant for right now?" Because I really was getting what you were throwing down. It's like, no, nothing.
Yeah, there's a lot of assumptions that we've changed several lines or added lines to be topically important right now, and we've changed nothing like that.
Can you share a couple of those?
There's some Supreme Court stuff going on in the show. I mean, even just passing references, it's not even an important plot point, but passing references to the Supreme Court that kind of, you know, elicits groans or laughter or applause every day. And, you know, I mean, it's a play about D.C. and politics in D.C. And I don't think that stuff has changed too much. It's about, you know, idealism versus cynicism. It's about big money versus, you know, representation of the people. And, you know, how do we take the promise of what democracy means to a people and kind of either squash it or lift it up? How can we make ourselves the best? And that's DC in a nutshell, I think, since the beginning of DC. And, you know, this play is just encapsulates it in a really kind of fun romantic comedy vibe. Yeah.
Same as it ever was.
Whether
you were born yesterday or back in the
40s, 50s, 60s.
That's right. And also, I think it in terms of the journey of my character, Billy, I think it represents a hopeful story for a good amount of us Americans that think that our voice doesn't matter, and that our opinions don't matter because we don't have the credentials to speak our voice and speak our opinions. And so when she realizes that even though she may not have all of the SAT words at her disposal, her voice is not only important but vital to the grand experiment that is America. I love those moments in the play where she realizes that no, she's just as important as anybody else, whether or not she's in, you know, in blonde highlights and red lipstick, you know, like it's, I don't know, it, or little nails. God, these nails are ridiculous. I grew my nails up for the show and I'm stabbing myself constantly.
Well, I mean, we've talked a lot about, you know, genre, theme, tone, social relevance, all that. But let's back it up 1 second. We're taking for granted that people know what the plot is. So who wants to take the basic premise?
Okay. It's about this girl. No.
It is, in fact, about this girl.
With long nails.
With long nails. Stabs herself all the time.
She's a masochist, really.
Yeah, she really is.
All right, for real.
For realsies. This man who has made a name for himself in the junk business, I guess you would call it, has come to D.C. To quote-unquote sightsee, but also to possibly meet up with some bigwigs in D.C. to deregulate some things that he wants to deregulate, so he can have more money in his pocket and more power. And he has with him a very successful arm candy that he's had for about 8 years, and that formula has worked for him in New York, having this Pretty Little Thing that is kind of funny and was a chorus girl, but now she's here in this DC world, which is in his eyes a little bit more proper, a little bit more gray, a little bit more conservative. And so he's worried that she's going to bumble his plans. So he wants her to change or get educated or get more conservative. And so he wheels and deals a plot to hire this news guy, this magazine writer, who's trying to interview him, trying to get the dirt on why he's really in D.C., to educate her. And so the journey of my story is that I you know, get in cahoots with this man who believes in democracy and believes in education and believes that everybody has the right to have their own kind of independence and 2 feet firmly planted on the ground, but that we also totally fall in love.
Hijinks ensue.
Hijinks ensue.
As in most plays.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's definitely of the there are hints and whiffs of Pygmalion and you know, My Fair Lady, but it's much more of a partnership than a "you have to speak like this if you want to
get ahead."
I think
in our production, certainly, we have... I mean, at its core, I think, even when written, this is a play about female empowerment, about, you know, a young woman coming into her own. And I think that there is a version of the more Pygmalion version of this where Paul, my character Paul, the reporter, he definitely could be a little more, "you need to do this, you should do this, you know, look at me helping you." And there's hints of that still, but I think we've made this much more of Billy's journey. We put, Aaron Posner, the director, really wanted to put Billy at the center of this story, and have it be that we're kind of the planets orbiting her son. And I think that's been very successful in this production, and we've come to realize that, and it's nice. It's good. Billy kind of flies free, which is great.
You mentioned the director just now. Take me into sort of how does he symbolically block it, or what do we see visually? You know, when we're sitting there in the theater, we've talked so much about the story and the themes, but what are we, paint a picture, we're radio, but paint a picture of what we're seeing here.
Dan Conway,
yes,
who
Dan
is
Conway.
The set designer who's worked a lot with Aaron throughout town and throughout the country, has built a two-story kind of classic DC hotel room. It's really beautiful in the Ford space, and Kelsey Hunt, the costume designer, she really has kind of popped these characters, brought them to life on this stage. So you walk in and you experience this really beautiful 40s vibe kind of right away. And Aaron's the director, his whole idea was just, let's make the best version of this 40s play we can. We're not going to mess around with it. We're not going to throw a lot of modern curveballs at it. Like, let's do this as it would have been done. And I think he's really done a great job. And so the block, I mean, I think that we all live within the style of a kind of 40s screwball comedy that tips romantic.
And when we were in the rehearsal space, because, you know, when you're rehearsing, you're not in the actual space because they're building the set. So we have these, like, mock-up lines on the stage, and we had mock-up stairs that don't really go anywhere because they're on the floor. And then we have, like, you know, rinky-dink tables, very nice, actually. Ford's does do a fantastic job of creating a very nice rehearsal space atmosphere. But they are stand-ins nonetheless. So what we learned when we got into the Ford's Theater, so you have the beautiful, majestic, awesome, hallowed vibe of Ford's Theater just to start out with, and then you have Dan Conway's set was just, it is opulent and beautiful. And then you have Kelsey Hunt's costumes. And so we were getting notes. I remember in, like, the first couple of days when we were in the space was, you really got it. Like, this character, this set is a character, and you have to match the grandiose, the grand, the I don't know, larger than life-ness.
Grandiosity.
Grandiosity. Yeah.
We need to fill the space.
You need to fill the space. So what we were doing in the rehearsal space was a little bit more natural, finding moments. He's like, okay, great, now do that and just amplify everything to 12.
We only go up to 11.
Sorry, WTOP. We go to 12 at the porch.
We're going to blow you out.
But what it did was actually it made us dive even further, deeper, or more forward into the style. And the style is what kind of anchors us in this grandiose set. And so I'm incredibly grateful. And it's a slightly raked stage. So you're on. You're literally, and I'm in heels, so like I'm literally on my toes. So it's like the energy is always moving forward.
Yeah.
It's exhausting.
Yeah, the style, I mean,
keeps you on your toes.
It does. Yeah. I think the style and how Aaron and the design team and the actors and everybody kind of met the script is really what makes this place sing. I mean, the performances are brilliant. The design is brilliant.
Oh my God, this cast is ridiculous.
But that we have tied it all together in this 40s style, I think, is what makes people really kind of go, ooh, and lean forward. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's why I wanted to be a part of it. It's not something I've done in this town, at least, kind of play this type of character in this mm-hmm. type of style. To get my teeth into that is super fun.
I feel like it's, in another interview, but I mean, it's like the idea of this character is what my 13-year-old self thought of as like, oh, a stage actress puts on this, and it's like I am the archetype of my 13-year-old self's like
first endeavor dream into false eyelashes, right?
Yes. Oh God.
You're the archetype.
So I have amazing friends that do musical theater. There are people that are in this show that are amazing musical theater performers. I am not one of those people, so I don't usually wear, you know, all this makeup and all the wigs and all the false and the long nails and the things and the corsets and so it's a new experience for me, but it because I yeah my career has been mainly like wearing sackcloth and
shaving your head.
My head. And
I shaved my head and wore sackcloth just for this interview. You guys can't see it.
Well, he looks
really
great.
Appreciate that. Oh, thanks,
guys.
You did your homework.
Oh, wow. Shucks. Well, I guess I should say, we're going to paint the town red. Yeah, see? That's how we're going to talk.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, awesome. Well, before we go, you mentioned your 13-year-old self. Tell me a little bit about you guys. Where are you from? How you got into acting? Abbreviated version, of course, because you both got to go and we're on the clock. But
I grew up outside of Philadelphia in Wallingford, Pennsylvania, and I am the youngest of 9 children. And all my brothers and sisters constantly quoted Monty Python around me growing up, many other TV shows and movies. And so scripted lines were always just kind of in my head. And it was always a dream of mine to recreate that kind of energy that they created around a coffee table, just riffing on each other with lines. And then I just found the platform to do that, which was the stage, and here we are.
And she's not dead yet.
I'm not dead yet.
How about you?
I grew up in Central North Carolina. I was born in Durham and grew up there and in Chapel Hill, and I'm the product of a nice public education with good arts programs, and got into theater in high school and kind of never looked back. The community that is created through art is something that I really think is beautiful, and collaborative art especially. And yeah, I've been doing it since I was 15 and never stopped, and don't see myself stopping anytime soon.
He ain't stopping.
Yeah.
Nor should you. All right. Well, before we go, just in closing, why should our listeners come out?
It's a beautiful, fun 2 hour plus of escape and reveling. Yeah, so I think it's a great balance of escape and relevant topics that will make you feel good and make you feel less alone in the world. And everybody loves a Cinderella story.
Yeah, straight up good romantic comedy vibe with scarily prescient writing from a, you know, playwright 60 years ago, 70 years ago. Still on point, still on topic. The American experiment is fragile. And it's funny, So come out and feel the funny.
Gotta good. Laugh sometimes. All right, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks
again,
for having
it's Born Yesterday at Ford's Theater now through October 21st. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you for having
You're
us.
You're welcome.